WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We are joined now by someone who some might say is an unlikely Twitterer, novelist and poet, Margaret Atwood. And she is here now to talk about her writing, Canadian political media controversies, and, of course, Twitter, where she has like 85,000 followers. Margaret Atwood, welcome to WNYC. Did I get that number right?
Well, it may be a bit more by the time people hear this. It's amazing how it just... things just kind of increase on Twitter.
So the obvious question is, as a novelist used to writing long form, how have you adjusted to getting an idea across in 140 characters or less? And were there barriers to you to even start in that form?
Well, how this all came about was that I decided to build a website for the Year of the Flood, which you can find at www.yearoftheflood.com. My website builder said, well, you have to have a blog, which I said, what's that? And then they said, you have to have a Twitter account, and I said, what's that? So they put those things onto my blog, and I said, how do I do this? And they said, well, you sign in here. So then I just kind of had to figure it out. And I did have a couple of people who retweeted me to their followers to get me started, as it were. And then you just sort of figure it out. But I have to say, you learn by doing. And one of the things that people should learn around about now, because lawsuits are now being instituted on the basis of Twittering and blogging, this is publishing. So you are, in fact, responsible for what you put up there. And if it's defamatory and false, sooner or later somebody's going to go after you for it, especially in this very litigious country.
So unlike somebody publishing through a publishing company or having an editor at a newspaper, you don't have an editor, you don't have media lawyers, but you're still responsible as if you are a publisher.
You are still responsible as if you are a publisher.
How did you get so many Twitter followers? I mean, a lot of...
search me.
No, you must have an... because a lot of writers, you know, have Twitter feeds and politicians and other media people, but not everybody has 85,000 followers. What did you first start writing that, you know, in that short form that caught fire?
Well, I think I just first started writing about the tour that I was doing. And that was a tour that combined these strange performances that we did that had a musical element, and it had a dramatic element, and I was the narrator, and we went from city to city doing this. And I initially got into that to support a bird conservation, believe it or not. And so I was also talking about things like organic coffee and how that's good for birds on my Twitter and blog, and I was taking pictures. And then I learned out how to do TwitPic, which is how you put a picture up on your Twitter. And you just learn these. And the thing about the Twitter folk is if you ask them a question, they will come out with all of this astounding amounts of information. So I have a follower of geeks, following of geeks. I've got a following of green people. I've got readers. I've got some rather strange trolls. And I have who knows? You know, who knows who's out there just not replying, but just watching what you're doing.
Is it satisfying in a different way to have that instant burst of community and response compared to writing novels?
Sometimes it's hilarious. If you start a kind of joke going, for instance, I started one during the Olympics, and it was that Canadians were saying, own the podium. So I put out a tweet saying I thought this was kind of un-Canadian. It was a bit brash. And what would my Twitter followers propose instead? And they were terrific. They came up with all these things like maybe a podium might be nice, or a podium for me, and rent the podium. Do you mind just squeezing over a bit so I can get up on the podium? And they kept this going, and they will do that. If it's anything linguistic or funny, they'll jump in.
And you can make those jokes because you are Canadian.
You mean you couldn't?
Well, I mean, you know, people can make jokes about their own group.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was about Canada. And I'm currently, of course, running. I seem to be running over the past 24 hours or so. I have a new friend called the Turnip, which is a turnip. And it's considering whether to run for the Prime Minister of Canada. And it's already got a political following because it's for accountability and transparency and listening to people and all those things that a turnip can do quite well.
Was there a reason you picked a turnip as opposed to, say, a Brussels sprout?
Well, I think it's a northern vegetable, and it has the common touch. It's very round. It looks at things from all angles. It doesn't have gender issues. Of course, neither would a Brussels sprout. There's a lot of good reasons for preferring the turnip.
Margaret Atwood, my guest on WNYC, novelist and tweeter. And you recently signed an online petition that sparked controversy with the Toronto Sun and in the Twitter world. Tell us about the petition and why you decided to sign it.
Well, the petition was just one of those things that popped up on my Twitter. And I frequently open things that people send to me that pop up on Twitter. And this was about a strange arrangement of events whereby a large media consortium in Canada was applying for a special license from a body called the CRTC, which is supposed to be an arm's length body governing such things. And there was some question as to the arm's lengthness, the pressure being put on that organization by the government, and the person who was supposed to be heading up the new, their own language, by the way, and their own application, Fox News, Canadian-style channel, had just gone from being the Prime Minister of Canada's personal assistant to being the head of this thing, or proposed thing. Now, this consortium already has a TV show, and it already has a lot of newspapers, so it is not a question of limiting its views in any way.
Although the Toronto Sun that said that by signing this petition, Margaret Atwood is supporting censorship.
Somebody in one of their columns said that, and then what happened? I mean, it's ridiculous to say that signing a petition is supporting censorship. If anything, it's the reverse. You know, petitions are there so that in a democracy people can sign them without being dangled from a lamppost. So anyway, I signed it like anybody else, and then somebody picked this out and started making heavy weather of it with all sorts of accusations directed at me, including that I had sold out to U.S. business interests because George Soros funded AVAZ, A-V-A-A-Z, which is the petition organization. Well, number one, he doesn't. It's just a lie.
Small detail.
Yeah, small detail. So the next thing we know, the head of this proposed news channel suddenly resigns. Why is that? Because he wrote a column saying that the petition contained all of these false names or names of real people who hadn't signed it. But just as in Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, he knew that before those names had appeared on the public list of names on the petition. Question, how did he know that? Answer, we don't know, but all the false sign-ins have been traced to one internet address in Ottawa. Bang, he's gone. That particular issue is gone, the false names issue, except for the police who now have been asked to investigate because it's fraud and it's identity fraud and it's misuse of a telecommunication service. Next thing happens, George Soros sues the guy who was beating him up with some really pretty defamatory stuff about George Soros' childhood as a Jewish person being hidden out by Christians during the war.
Whoa.
Whoa. heavy weather, saying he was a Nazi collaborator. I mean, that is, those are fighting words.
So what's the bottom line with
bottom
this
line
on
is
TV?
That Twitter is powerful. Well, right. The next bottom line was that some of the guys there, you know, they're just journalists, and I happen to know one of them. And back and forth, he was explaining to
what
me.
What do you mean, just journalists?
They're journalists. They don't have an overriding. They're not ideologues first and journalists second. They're journalists first. That is, they have some respect for the truth and accuracy, which is what you want in a media outlet, is it not?
So you've got this ongoing Twitter argument with the conservative blogger over this whole thing.
No, not particularly. That's gone. Because he's the guy who got sued. So the son, I said to the son, well, you and I know a lot of the stuff that came out about me is potentially lawsuit, but why don't I just do a piece in your paper? So I did on Sunday. It's an editorial in the Sun, and it just goes through the falsehoods, or as many of them as I could get into 600 words, and says, this is what they said. Here, on the other hand, is the truth.
And is that where the turnip for a prime minister campaign
began?
Exactly
where the turnip.
You wrote, I'd vote for a turnip if it was accountable, transparent,
yes, exactly.
A parliamentary Democrat, and listen to people.
Yeah, I'm not a card-carrying member of any political party, and I have voted for just about all of them.
Card-carrying member of a vegetable, perhaps.
Well, I haven't issued the card. The turnip is still thinking about whether it's going to run. You have to give up quite a lot to run in politics. It would have to give up gardening and its family life.
So do you want people to...
that may be.
Yeah, it could be a very robust, you know, warm family life. Do
well,
you
I
want
feel that the turnip has the common touch. You know, it's not snooty like those heritage beets. It's just down to earth.
Do you want people to tweet at Margaret Atwood whether or not the turnip should actually run for prime minister?
Well, it already has a lot of people telling it to run, but it has to ponder very seriously. And, you know, it doesn't jump to conclusions, the turnip.
Your most recent novel, The Year of the Flood, it is set in the not-too-distant future after civilization, as we know it, has been destroyed by a virus. Tell us briefly about the world you imagine in the wake of that destruction.
Well, of course, what would happen is what happens in any catastrophe as soon as the communication circuits go down. One thing is that people don't know what's happening to other people. And another thing that happens, of course, is that the electricity goes off. And once the electricity goes off, there is a cascading effect. And all of that is simply added to the fact that you have a very instantaneous type of virus let loose in the population. And I will add in here that we now, as the human race, have the capacity to make such a thing. It's not. It doesn't come from Mars. We could do that now.
Survival is a crucial theme in your writing. Do you feel it's threatened?
My own personal survival or our survival?
Well, let's say our.
Down the road, we're in trouble. Actually, we're in trouble right now, but we don't yet know how much trouble we're in. And the bottom line is you can't argue with chemistry and physics. Just coming down here on the plane, I was talking to a guy who's in this field. I'm old enough to pick up people on planes. And he was telling me about ocean warming and what sorts of things they were measuring and so on and so on and so forth. And he says, it's no longer a question. It's happening. How bad is it going to get? Well, the knock-on effects are going to be less food. That's going to affect everybody. And we're also going to have more extreme weather events. You could read Bill McKibben's book called EAARTH, and he pretty much lays it out and also tells us what steps we should be taking to mitigate the effects that have already been let loose. So there are things we can do, yes.
In the past, you've emphasized the difference between science fiction and speculative fiction. Is that what you call this book?
I would call it that, but if you want to put science fiction as a huge banner over the top, you know those genealogies of the Tudors that you get to figure out who's married to whom. Okay, so we put science fiction over the top and then some subsets coming down out of it, one of which would be science fiction proper in a galaxy far, far away with talking vegetation and the rest. Another one would be speculative fiction, which descends from people like Jules Verne, who were looking at stuff we'd already invented or were in the process of inventing it and taking that a bit further. Or you could go to science fiction fantasy, or just fantasy, sword and sorcery fantasy, what with dragons and magicians. That's not science fiction exactly, but it's in the same world. And somebody else invented a category called slipstream fiction, which is all those books that make you feel very, very strange, but aren't what you would call science fiction proper.
And you put yourself
speculative
where?
Fiction.
Speculative fiction.
Yes, I do the fact checking. I do the research. I don't go really far outside the human planet Earth place where we are right now.
Do you hope to have a political impact with your writing, or don't you think about it explicitly that way?
I don't think about it explicitly that way. But if by political you mean should we think about what we're doing, sure. If by political I mean vote for this party, I don't know, because I don't know what the party is offering. I'd rather look at the offerings rather than the labels. You know, what are they going to actually do?
Are you writing another novel presently?
I am presently laboring to write another novel and trying to keep Twitter from taking over my entire life.
Well, has Twitter influenced your novel writing?
I don't think Twitter... Yes, it has. Yes, it has, and I'll tell you how. Through Twitter, you can connect with people who can tell you things you might want to know about your novel writing. For instance, I put out a call for how do I get to a hacker's convention, and boy, did I get a lot of interesting answers. I already have the black hat, and I have the offer of chaperones, which I would need to have a chaperone, and they said, leave your laptop at home. So this is a whole thing that Twitter can do for you. It can connect you to areas of information that you might want to know.
But you don't expect to beta test any sentences.
You never know.
You, by the way, you have 85,000 plus followers. You only follow 100 people. Is there a Twitter feed that you would recommend that we all follow?
Well, I don't know which ones. You mean that I recommend that you should follow?
Yes.
Okay, the latest one, because I just found out about it, and I found out about it because I'm going to be on the show, is called The Big Think. I didn't know about The Big Think. So for the geeky world, which we've just been talking about, what with the black hats, The Big Think looks really good, and I look forward to exploring their website, and I'm sure they've got a Twitter feed.
So great to talk to you. Thank you very
much. Lovely to talk to you.